It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Jay Carlisle Larson. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up later, we'll hear about efforts to track flu activity in Wisconsin.
First, it's time for our weekly look at the top news from Washington. The White House is continuing to face tough questions over its handling of a staffer who'd been accused of domestic abuse. That's got some people calling for the resignation of Chief of Staff John Kelly. Also, as part of the president's proposed budget, the food stamp program would be partially reworked into a meal delivery service. We're looking at those stories and more.
And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. How do you feel about the White House's response to Staff Secretary Rob Porter's abuse allegations? Should someone be held accountable? And what are your thoughts on the food stamp program transitioning in part to delivery meal kits to low-income families? Call 800-642-1234. Again, that's 800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org.
Amanda Turkle is the Washington Bureau Chief for the Huffington Post. Amanda, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Let's start with former White House Staff Secretary Rob Porter. He recently resigned after reports came out that he physically abused his ex-wives. The White House is facing a lot of questions over how it handled Porter's employment, his background checks, and more. Can you spell out the story a little bit for us?
Sure. So Rob Porter, he's a top staffer. He's staff secretary in the White House, which basically means he sees every piece of paper that goes to the president's desk. He's a very close aide. And it ends up that he, you know, his ex-wives have come forward, said that he physically abused them. And there have been photos, too, showing what he did to one of his ex-wives. And the question is, what did the White House know? When did they know it? It's been clear that he has not been able to get security clearance. And the FBI now has said that it told the White House this on several occasions. The White House said that that information never got to top officials like the White House counsel and the White House chief of staff. But that timeline doesn't really work for a lot of people. There are reports that White House chief of staff John Kelly knew about the allegations for months. Kelly is saying that he didn't know how serious they were until he saw the pictures, and then he quickly told Porter he needed to go, but other people are disputing that. So it seems like John Kelly in particular, and also the White House counsel, seem to be stuck in this situation where they didn't maybe take this as seriously as they should have. They protected Rob Porter. And a lot of people within the White House are actually upset at the way it was handled.
Right. John Kelly, initially when the reports came out as chief of staff, had defended Porter, said very positive things about him. Also, Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders read a statement that seemed supportive of him. And then after Porter was out, President Trump said what people read as very positive things about him without mentioning the victims of his alleged spousal abuse. What kind of criticism has there been since all of that?
Right. President Trump said that it's very sad what happened, and he meant sad what happened to Rob Porter, not sad what happened to the women. He never actually mentioned the women and never said that, he hopes that they're okay. And he said that Porter did a great job, and he said he hopes he'll have a wonderful career. And then he made a point of mentioning it's important to note that Rob Porter has denied the allegations, and that's very important for everyone to keep in mind. That's what Donald Trump stressed, which, again, made a lot of people upset. The White House obviously does not have the best track record, starting with the president himself, when it comes to taking allegations by women on sexual harassment, sexual assault seriously. And here you have, not just allegations, but photographic proof. And you have the president there saying he's a good guy, sad what's happening, he's leaving, but, he says he's innocent, so maybe we should believe him. It's not, like I said, even within the White House, there are staffers who are saying, like, this is not good.
Advancing now to the last couple of days, earlier today, President Trump specifically said he condemns domestic abuse. And with the FBI timeline versus the White House timeline, here's Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders. I think this was yesterday, talking about why the FBI's findings didn't result in Porter being out of a job earlier.
The FBI portion was closed. The White House Personnel Security Office, who is the one that makes a recommendation for adjudication, had not finished their process and therefore not made a recommendation to the White House.
what questions are still open about the FBI's timeline versus the White House timeline?
Well, the FBI again said that we let the White House know. Did those concerns ever get up to the top levels? The White House says no. You know, the FBI hasn't clarified that. But it seems like, you know, again, Rob Porter has, you know, an outstanding pedigree. He's Ivy League educated. He's the son of a famous academic. He seemed like he was sort of this golden boy in the White House. And so was there an attempt to protect him? You know, in a lot of ways, he was sort of supposed to be one of the grown-ups in the White House. He wasn't causing all the drama that we hear from other people going on there. And so did people buy into that image too much and buy into the word of what this man was saying versus what his ex-wives were saying and protect him in a way that, you know, he shouldn't, you know, he committed these, he, you know, abused his ex-wives and shouldn't have been given a security clearance, shouldn't be in the White House. Did they just sort of look the other way because of his image?
And Congress is taking an interest. The House Oversight Committee today announced it'll be investigating the administration's hiring of Porter and the security clearances. Here's Republican Committee Chairman Trey Gowdy talking about what he wants to know.
Who knew what, when, and to what extent? And if you knew it in 2017 and the Bureau briefed him three times, then how in the hell was he still employed? The security clearance is a separate issue. I mean, it's an important issue, but it's separate. How do you have any job if you have credible allegations of domestic abuse?
So even some Republicans in Congress putting pressure on the White House here.
Absolutely. This is the condemnation so far has been bipartisan. And, you know, like I said, John Kelly trying to get a story out there that he acted immediately when he found out. President Trump's comments of, well, Porter says he's innocent, so maybe we got to believe him. Those have not gone over well, including with Republicans. I mean, domestic violence is not a partisan issue. And, you know, I think a lot of people are concerned that the White House maybe looked the other way on this and protected him.
Talking to Amanda Turkle from the Huffington Post, where she's Washington bureau chief, looking at some of the top stories in national politics. Let's turn now to the president's budget. A lot there, of course, increased spending for defense and border security, cuts to foreign aid and domestic programs. One thing, Amanda, that's gotten a lot of attention, a change in the food assistance program. What is the administration looking at doing here?
Sure. So right now, food stamps. It's known as the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, commonly known as food stamps. So if you're in that program, you basically get $125 approximately per person each month, a food voucher. And then you can use that as money. You can go to a grocery store and buy basically any food product. But the White House wants to change that. So if you get $90 or more per month in benefits, you'll get some of those benefits in the form of a food package. So you won't just get the voucher to spend. So you might get some sort of like ready to drink shelf stable milk, cereals, pasta, peanut butter, canned fruits and vegetables, meat, you know, things like that. So basically the federal government would be choosing what you eat instead of giving you money that you can then spend to decide what you want to eat. And so this is incredibly controversial. In a lot of ways, people say it's less efficient, and people are also finding it, honestly, a little bit judgmental because there's often this sort of criticism of people who are on food stamps that they're just buying junk food, that they're buying sugary snacks, that they're not spending their money in the way that people think they should be spending their money. When the evidence doesn't actually bear that out, they tend to buy the same food and the same mix of food that everyone else does. But, you know, so this has a little bit of judgmental a side effect of it that, you know, if you are not poor enough to have enough money and you need this government help, we're going to pick the food that we think you should be eating.
I want to bring on a caller. Lisa is with us in Janesville. Lisa, hi.
Hi. How's it going? Thanks for taking my call. I am a food share recipient. And for the last 3 years, 2 years, we've had the state Senate wanting to tell me what to eat. We've had the federal government wanting to tell me what to eat. I mean, all of these entitlement programs are, there's constant government in my pocket, which I shouldn't say that. So I'm not saying that there needs to be some work on these programs. But the problem is A, what happens if you got people with dietary needs, has specific dietary needs, and they, or they're a vegetarian or anything else? Are we not allowed to do that. And the other thing is what we need to focus on, rather than choosing what people have to do, why don't we focus on education? And instead of requiring, you know, recipients not to smoke drugs or take pizza, how about if we just educate people on how to eat nutritionally, how to shop nutritionally and economically, instead of just take our things away from us?
Lisa, thanks for the call. I want to bring on another caller, Matthew in Western Wisconsin. Matthew, hi.
Hey, how's it going?
Thanks. Good. What do you think about this?
Well, touching on what Lisa just said, in addition to the special dietary requirements, I mean, it makes a little bit of sense in larger metropolitan areas like Milwaukee, Racine, Madison, those types of areas, to where this program could potentially at least help people. But in rural areas, like rural Wisconsin, where a lot of low-income families might get SNAP benefits, but they only go to the grocery store, say, once a week or once every 2 weeks. In certain areas, there isn't even like the Meals on Wheels program for senior citizens. And touching on that, how are these going to get delivered to them? Also with the nutrition, I mean, it might cut down the cost in the short term for the generalized Joe Schmo package that gets put out to people. But like Lisa said, with special dietary requirements, it's going to astronomically increase the cost if you have to specialize each individual meal plan and meal package to a family or an individual.
Gotcha, Matthew. I want to bring Amanda back in. Are we hearing some objections to this, as we heard from Lisa and Matthew here?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, the notion that people who may be low income can't decide for themselves what's best for them and their families, again, is just incredibly judgmental, and it's making these sort of value decisions that I don't think are fair and that the evidence doesn't bear out. You know, dietary restrictions are a great point. Or what if, you know, you get a bunch of green beans that month and you just don't like green beans? You know, why should, and you know, you, that is taking away from your allotment. You know, this is a government benefit, and people should be able to spend the money on the food that they think fits their family. You know, maybe there's a sale and they want to stock up on something. So there's a lot of pushback to this, and it didn't help that the White House referred to it as a sort of blue apron approach. And you know, it's nothing like blue apron. Blue apron is sort of a program where you get ingredients for gourmet meals, not boxes of canned goods and shelf-stable milk. And, you know, the point is to make it more convenient for your cook. I mean, this is, it's not at all, and that comparison just isn't going over well. It's not helping the government's case.
We're talking to Amanda Turkle, Washington Bureau Chief for the Huffington Post, looking at the top stories in national news.
And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. After another court ruling blocked the Justice Department from ending the DACA program in March, do you think it should continue? What solution would you like to see Congress come up with for DACA recipients? And are you concerned about hacking and election interference from countries such as Russia? Do you think more should be done to address it? Call in now at 800-642-1234. Again, that's 800-642-1234.
We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Verrett.
And I'm Jay Carlisle Larson. Right now, we continue our talk with Amanda Turkle. She's the Washington Bureau Chief at the Huffington Post. She's with us to talk about the biggest news from Washington.
Coming up, we'll get to some legislative election results around the country, Russian hacking, and more. You can weigh in at 800-642-1234. DACA, Amanda, the program that protected people brought into the country illegally as minors. The president said he's ending the program. Congress is working on this March 5th deadline, and now a federal judge in New York blocked the Trump administration from ending the program. Another judge now, the second ruling against the plan. What is the latest?
So right now, yeah, a second judge has blocked it, and the government is trying to appeal it. But if the Supreme Court doesn't want to take up the case, there's a good chance that it is blocked. And it's not the government's, the Trump administration has the power to end the program. But the issue is whether they can bar people who are already in the program from renewing their applications and getting to stay in the country. So the question now is the Supreme Court going to take it up and appeal, and will the government have another chance?
And Congress now has this big task in front of it. They were working on some kind of deal to keep DACA recipients in the country and do other stuff with immigration, border security, and more. Are they looking at this court ruling and saying, oh, okay, we've got longer, or are they still plowing ahead on this?
They are still plowing ahead, and they say they are, but, you know, in the back of their minds, they're looking at this and seeing that they might have a little bit more time. I mean, immigration advocates for quite a while have been saying, like, look, you think you have until March, but people are not able to renew before then. This is actually much more urgent than it seems, and Congress generally hasn't really seemed to have any urgency. So immigration is something that they're working on right now, but to be honest, they're not close to a deal. It's not clear that the Senate and the House can come up with something that they agree on. It's not clear whether even the Senate can come up with something, which is where a lot of the action is right now. So they are working on it, but it right now it doesn't look great for a deal.
And the president's looking for cutbacks in currently legal forms of immigration, funding for the border wall. And he, as I understand it, says he would veto a bill that strayed too far from what he wants. Is that right?
Right. As I was saying, you know, you have differences between the parties, differences between the chambers, and like you point out, you have a difference with the president. And some of what the president is demanding, like these changes to legal immigration programs, Democrats just say are non-starters, and they're not going along with that.
We're talking to Amanda Turkle from the Huffington Post about some of the top stories in national politics right now. You can join in at 800-642-1234. And we will go to a caller now. We've got Ruben on the line in Madison. Ruben, hi.
Hey, how you doing today?
Good. What do you think, Ruben?
So I'm an immigrant myself, and I just wanted to make a couple of comments. It's not as easy as people think. A lot of times in the news and the media, you think, why didn't these people get it together in the first place? Because a lot of times it takes a lot of money, it takes a lot of effort, a lot of paperwork. You got to pay lawyers to go through the process. You know, you're not attorneys to go through the immigration process. So it's not as black and white and as easy as it a lot of people think. Why did they didn't get it together a long time ago? So. Sometimes it can take easily 10, 15 years before you're finally able to get to a place where you're a permanent resident alien and then a citizen. The other comment real quick I want to make is that a lot of times I'll see comments in the news or in social media from other immigrants who are now citizens or who maybe were political refugees and received asylum at some point or another for some political reason who say, hey, they didn't get it together. I paid my dues. I went through the legal way and they should as well. Well, the expression I was used as well, black and white Americans showed you empathy and allowed, you know, for you to be in this country in the first place, you know. So that's the same empathy that these individuals are looking for, you know. Nobody cares if you're undocumented and a criminal. Yeah, everybody's agreement, deport those. But people who are contributing to the economy, contributing to society, you know, the same empathy that some of these other immigrants for various reasons or situations were allowed, you know, a path to citizenship.
Ruben, I'm going to jump in because we don't have too much time. Amanda, is Ruben on track with what some Democrats are saying in this debate?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think empathy is something that you don't hear necessarily a lot in the debate in Washington about this. You do from some supporters of the Dreamers, obviously. And, you know, that's part of why the Dreamer movement has been so powerful is that these young people are people, you know, I think, you know, individuals who aren't even involved in the immigration debate at all can really relate to and how hard it would be for them to be sent back to these countries that they don't know.
Ruben, thanks for that call. Amanda, I want to get to a couple more issues in national news. First, intelligence leaders are warning of more Russian hacking ongoing now, efforts to sway now the 2018 election. Want to give a listen to Dan Coats, National Director of Intelligence, talking to the Senate Intelligence Committee.
Frankly, the United States is under attack by entities that are using cyber to penetrate virtually every major action that takes place in the United States.
And did other intelligence leaders agree with Coates on this?
Yes, it is a major concern for the intelligence leaders. It's already happening for 2018. You know, obviously we saw this in 2016. And you know, the country is not completely prepared for it. A lot of it is through this sort of misinformation campaign, you know, using digital strategies, social media to basically divide the country more, to get both sides. You know, you hear all the time about how Americans are so divided, and that's true. And that would probably be true without election interference from, you know, Russia or whatever. But it certainly doesn't help when you have these bad actors coming in and artificially inflating those tensions. And so they're worried about that, and they're worried about, you know, other cybersecurity threats. But it's a big issue, and I think that, you know, as they said, we're just not prepared for them.
Finally, Amanda, people are watching a state legislative special elections around the country, trying to find tea leaves for the big elections this fall. Last week had a result in Missouri, yesterday in Florida. What are we seeing?
Well, it's been Donald Trump's presidency has been very good in getting elected, getting Democrats elected. So on Tuesday, Democrats flipped their 36th legislative seat, state legislative seat, since Trump won the presidency. So those are seats that were in Republican control and that Democrats have now won. Republicans, meanwhile, have flipped just four. So that's a big, big difference. And Republicans have traditionally been far more dominant at the state level. They still are. But this is very troubling that for Republicans that Democrats are taking these Republican seats, and many of them are in districts that Trump won pretty big.
We'll leave it there for now. Amanda, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Amanda Turkle. She's the Washington Bureau Chief for the Huffington Post. She joined us for our weekly look at some of the top national stories in politics.
First, we're in the midst of Wisconsin's worst flu season in years, and public health officials are doing everything they can to stop the spread of the disease. In order to do that, they need all of the help they can get, and that's where our next guest comes in.
WisContext recently reported on an intricate disease tracking network that's been built up over time in Wisconsin, one that tracks the prevalence of influenza cases around the state.
The result is a statewide picture of the flu, what strains are affecting communities, and a look at how well flu vaccines are working. And the same lab tracks national trends for the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention.
Pete Schultz is director of the Wisconsin State Laboratory of Hygiene's Communicable Disease Division. Pete, thanks for joining us today.
Glad to speak to you.
Well, tell us a little more about the work your division is doing and the goals of the work.
One of the things, I'm at the Wisconsin State Lab of Hygiene, so we're Wisconsin State Public Health Laboratory. We deal with a lot of public health issues, and at this time of the year, one of the key things that we're involved with is doing laboratory diagnosis of influenza to support outbreak response and to support influenza surveillance efforts, both in the state and at the national level.
And that was interesting to me. You're responsible for the state, but because of money from the CDC, you're also one of, as I understand it, three agencies around the country that's tracking a whole bunch of states.
Yeah, our primary focus is doing our laboratory efforts to support our Division of Health. We're actually a part of the University of Wisconsin-Madison administratively, but we support our state health department by statute. So our real focus and efforts go to carrying out that mission. However, we have had the opportunity to apply for funding to essentially become a reference laboratory in support of the CDC, and we're one of three such laboratories. They're called National Influenza Reference Centers. The other labs are in New York and California. And basically, we're providing expanded capacity for CDC to serve other states, to serve other state public health laboratories, and take a little burden off of the CDC, doing some of the more routine and initial characterization of influenza, so that CDC can really be focusing their efforts on much higher level testing and also supporting their mission, which is actually a global mission.
And Pete, when I open my mail, given my job, I'm getting books from publishers, I'm getting press releases. You're getting, this time of year, the flu, right? People are sending you the flu.
Yeah, we are. We are getting we get a lot of specimens. Now, again, we get specimens from throughout the state in support of outbreak response in long-term care facilities or schools. But we also get specimens from many other clinical laboratories within the state who do their own measure of influenza testing. And then we do further characterization of those specimens and send those specimens on to CDC for even more characterization. The other thing we do is not only get specimens from throughout the state, but there's probably about 45 to 48 other clinical laboratories associated with hospitals and so on who do influenza testing. So we're able to gather their data on a weekly basis. And these laboratories are scattered throughout the state, so we really get a good picture from the laboratory perspective of what viruses are out there. We do the further characterization on them and the level of testing that they're doing. So we get a good idea of how much flu is out about the state and exactly what influenza viruses are circulating.
Yeah, that's one of the things you're looking at with the flu virus. There's all these different strains of flu. We don't know coming into a flu season which one we're going to see. That's, I guess, a big part of what you're doing there, right?
It is. On an annual basis, I mean, the major reasons we're doing what we're doing is we're trying to characterize the influenza season as it progresses. And this year is shaping up to be historic in its scope. We also look for novel influenza viruses that may have come from an animal source that could be a harbinger for a pandemic of influenza. And we haven't seen those. We're really focused on the seasonal influenza. And then actually the testing we do here helps with CDC's characterization of these viruses so that they can go on and make the decisions essentially for next year's vaccine. And then we also monitor these viruses. Right now, we're relying heavily on the use of antivirals in those people who are sick with influenza. So we do the characterization to make sure that those antivirals are still effective. And so far, fortunately, this season, there are. So this is a good season where right now we've predominantly had the influenza A, H3, a strain, which is causing all the major outbreak here. But there's another another influenza A, the H1, as well as influenza B, which are also now beginning to circulate. So we're really experiencing the worst effects from the H3 virus, but we have to pay attention to those other viruses now that may come a little later in the season and extend our influenza season well into the spring.
We're talking to Pete Schultz from the Wisconsin State Laboratory of Hygiene, looking at a flu testing analysis and then what we do with that data. And Pete, let's talk about that. You're not just doing this for the heck of it. What kind of data goes back out to, say, healthcare providers so they can know what they're in for?
Right. What we do now, we work closely with the epidemiologists at the State Division of Health, and they're monitoring illness in the community in terms of the number of people who are showing up at clinics with influenza-like illness. They're monitoring hospitalizations and also pediatric deaths. So they're really looking at the numbers of sick people. What we're doing to complement that is by analyzing these specimens and collecting these other laboratory data, we're able to see what viruses are circulating in the state that are causing this illness, the relative magnitude or number of these, the number of specimens are being tested, and how many of those specimens are positive, which is a good indicator of, you know, where we are in the flu season. And then, as I mentioned, so we give the virologic picture that kind of correlates with what they're seeing, the illness they're seeing in the community. And the other thing we do, there's a lot of other viruses circulating. So if it's not influenza, it's very useful to know what other viruses are circulating and perhaps making these people sick. So we take our particular data set and we share that with Division of Health so they can kind of correlate to the clinical picture they're seeing in the community. And we do this by posting it on our website. We send reports to them on a weekly basis. We're in essentially daily contact with them. And we also share these data and this information with clinicians around the state and also the clinical laboratories who kind of help populate that database so that they're aware of what's going on in their communities as well.
And Pete, I understand you're concerned about funding for efforts like yours and others around the state and the country. Where do things stand right now?
Well, right now, and I think, there have been a number of press reports now with the different budget submissions at the national level that indicate there could be substantial cuts to the CDC. In terms of influenza surveillance around the country and in our state and local levels, it all begins and is driven and directed by the CDC. And they provide funding to help support these efforts, not only for influenza, but for other diseases of public health importance. So there, some of the money that's allocated to CDC actually funnels its way down to the state and to the local levels. Furthermore, serving as a national influenza reference center, that's funding we get directly from the CDC to help them carry out their mission to do this national surveillance. So if CDC's funding gets threatened, not only will our capability to serve as a national influenza reference center be compromised, because I can't use state dollars to do that, our ability to do the level of surveillance we do in the state will be equally compromised. And that data that I'm able to get out to Division of Health or to clinicians around the state, I would fear that we would have to kind of ramp back on that, and that would not be a good thing.
And Pete, you mentioned earlier this is a historic flu season. How does it compare to seasons past? It's, as I understand it, it's not maybe the worst we've ever seen.
Well, looking at it again, following mainly the CDC's party line here. From my perspective in my laboratory, we're as busy this season as we've ever been, with the pandemic in 2009 being the clear exception. Because at that time when the pandemic occurred, we were the only one of the only testing facilities in the state to be able to handle that particular virus, especially when it first emerged. But beyond that, it's looking like the busiest, as busy a season in my laboratory as we've ever had. Now, when you look at the CDC's data and public health data in general, looking at the level of illness in the communities, all the parameters that are being measured, number of people presenting to primary care, people being hospitalized, pediatric deaths, are now approaching some of the highest levels since those types of data have been assembled. And CDC has articulated that in the cases of like hospitalization and so on, they're approaching the levels we saw during the 2009 pandemic. And the last really severe year that we had, which would be 2014-2015, it's looking like we're pushing past that. And we have yet to reach our peak this season. So from a historical perspective, this is certainly turning out to be one of the most severe years we, the global public health community, have seen, and certainly one of the worst I've seen as being a director in this laboratory.
I'll let you get back to work then, Pete. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Glad to do it. Always glad to help.
That was Pete Schultz, director of the Wisconsin State Laboratory of Hygiene's Communicable Disease Division. He joined us to talk about efforts to track the flu in Wisconsin and beyond. For more on this story and other aspects of the flu in Wisconsin, head on over to wiscontext.org.
first, your dog needs desperately a walk. He needs to go outside, but there's some nice new snow out there and you really want to go cross-country skiing instead. Well, don't worry, you can do both at the same time.
It's called skijoring, and it harnesses the boundless energy of your dog and combines it with the grace of cross-country skiing.
Michelle Flanagan-Haig is a competitive cross-country skier and skijoring enthusiast. Michelle, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So can you paint us a picture of how skijoring, how the setup works?
Well, the setup can be a little tricky if you're trying to get your skis and your harness and the dog all combined to make this magical movement work. You got to put your harness on your dog first. And then put one on yourself and then hook them together, get your skis and your poles coordinated, and then get the dog. So there's just a little bit of tension on that harness. And then when all that's in place, then the dog just kind of picks up on your energy and you pick up on his, and away you go.
So the dog is connected to you. You're on your skis. You're at the start line. How did you get into the sport?
Well, quite by accident. The first year, we just got asked to do it, and I thought, well, we have a fun dog, and my husband did it with Teak, who was our original Golden Retriever, and it was the first year of the Barkaberkey that Connie Meek had set up, as well as my friend Susan Bauer. And so we got invited to do it, so we signed up and kind of just did it off the cuff, and it was so much fun. We kind of got hooked on it. So the second year, I did it with our other dog. And at that point we had two different dogs. And so my husband and I both were doing it at that point. So, kind of just fell into it, and it was just a fun thing to do with the Berkey.
So, I'll admit that I'm a big fan of dogs. If I go, what kind of dogs am I likely going to see at, the Barkey Berkey?
Well, if you're going to observe, you're going to see everything from big, huge St. Bernards and sled dogs all the way down to tiny little dachshunds and Bichons. And people do it with all different kinds of dogs, which makes it really super energetic and fun to watch. It's just such a fun spectator sport as well as sport to do.
It does seem like a lot of fun across the board for the skiers, for the people on the sidelines, and also it seems like for the dogs. How do you keep the dogs, I guess, on track during a sport if they just want to run?
Well, that's the tricky part. And so you have a handler that's there with you. It's somebody you pick. It's either a friend, like with us, it was a friend if my husband and I are both doing it. Otherwise, if one of us is just doing it, the other one is the handler. And the dogs just want to have fun. It's all about fun, and that was the lesson that my husband had to give me, because the first year I did it, I didn't want to do it because I was more focused on the Berkey, and that's what I was worried about, was getting the dog set so that my skis were under me and my poles were on, and I wasn't going to fall and break all my equipment, so then I would have nothing left to do the Berkey with. So, you know, I was nervous thinking, how am I going to do this? And my husband just laughed, and he said, "Shell," he said, "it's all about fun. That's all the dog wants, is to have fun." So you have a handler there getting the dog ready to have fun. They're just fired up to have fun because the atmosphere is just tangible with excitement from the dogs and the skiers. So the handler helps you get your dog between your skis and your poles and holds it there while the tension is mounting and your turn comes. And then when it's your turn to go, you got to make sure your weight is back, which is something of a beginner's mistake I made the first year, and went water skiing down the street on my face.
We're talking to Michelle Flanagan-Haig right now. She's a competitive cross-country skier and a skijoring enthusiast. And for the uninitiated, skijoring is, in this case, cross-country skiing with your dog as the dog sort of runs ahead of you. And it's a race. So, Michelle, maybe someone who is listening in has a dog with boundless energy and maybe also likes to cross-country ski. What tips do you have for someone who might be interested in getting into skijoring?
Well, the first thing is to get your dog used to having the harness on its body, because that can be something that they aren't used to, and that might impede some of the excitement that is bound up in them. So getting them out and getting them used to that, getting them used to pulling. A lot of dogs are taught not to pull on their leash, so it's kind of the opposite of what you've been training your dog to do. Bigger dogs obviously are going to pull you better, although I have seen some little dogs pull quite well, which is entertaining. But yeah, the biggest thing is to get your dog used to the harness, used to pulling, and that it's okay to pull. And then maybe a few commands here and there. My husband likes to use ye and ha for left and right, and I tried that with Brewster, and none of that was working. He wasn't going to listen. And finally, when he saw other dogs that were pulling and he started pulling, then it was just, yeah, Brewster, and they love that command, and that's been our command ever since. Just, yeah, Brewster, and he goes.
And he goes. Yeah. He knows what that means at this point. Maybe for other people who are curious, just how fast are you able to go with the aid of a dog with you?
Probably about 4 times as fast as you would without the dog. So, I mean, the wind makes your hair fly, and it's exciting. I mean, it feels like a roller coaster ride. You're going, and there's no stopping it. So it's pretty fast. But it's fun. I mean, a lot of times if the dog is pulling you that fast, you don't need to use your poles. You just need to skate. Or, you know, if it's a slight downhill, you just kind of tuck in and slow yourself down so you're not passing your dog, kind of thing. So it's very fun, very exhilarating, very adrenaline-producing, fun, super fun sport. So.
And so can you tell me about the Barky Berkey that is coming up on the 22nd?
That's the one that is obviously with the Berkey. It's a big, super fun event, like you said, something that everybody can watch, and you don't need a lot of experience. Obviously, my husband and I didn't have any experience the first time we did it, but we did take our dogs out and put them on the harnesses and have them ski drill with us months in advance. They run with us all the time on the Berkey Trail. So they do a lot of our ski training with us when it's the running type, and they bike with us. So we do that, and then when the Bark of Berkey comes around, the atmosphere is obviously Berkey fever. It's on Thursday before the race, so people are in town. It's just a fun, super fun atmosphere. It's also on the same day as, I believe, the giant ski, where a bunch of people ski on one ski and try to coordinate that effort, which is also very, very entertaining. The children's Berkey, the Barna Berkey is also on that day, so a lot of fun excitement in downtown Hayward, and Berkey fever is just alive and tangible in the air, so not to be missed.
It sounds like there is a lot of fun to be had in Hayward coming up in just about a week. Michelle, thank you so much for joining us today. This was fun.
It was my pleasure. Thank you.
That was Michelle Flanagan-Haig. She is a competitive cross-country skier and skijoring enthusiast. The Barky Berkey skijoring competition will be held on February 22nd in Hayward.
It's Valentine's Day, and there have been a lot of ads and promotions, especially in the food and candy industries.
The online magazine New Food Economy got in on the action, nominating some of the worst Valentine's Day food promotions.
And on their list, KFC, formerly known as Kentucky Fried Chicken, is giving away a special scratch and sniff Valentine's card that smells like, you're not going to guess, chicken. But to get it, you have to order $10 worth of chicken. So you've probably already got the smell all over you, never to come out. So I don't know if you can really test whether the card actually smells like fried
chicken. Yeah, I feel maybe at that point you would just smell like chicken. And maybe for some people, they're like, hey, that spells romance. I'm not sure how widespread that is. But another winner in sort of the worst promotions were heart-shaped bagels at Einstein's Bagels. It does make you question, maybe philosophically, if a bagel isn't round, is it even really a bagel?
Right. I saw it for a while. People were trying to come up with square bagels. I was never sure what the point was in that. We had our own little celebration. Peter over in IT,
yep.
he'll bring in donuts on Friday the 13th, mm-hmm. and on Valentine's Day, he writes poems related to it, and he brings in a whole mess of chocolate.
He brought in so much chocolate.
I had to stop myself
for
my
to enjoy. It was delicious and well appreciated, Peter. So thank you, and please continue to do that.
A fine food way to celebrate Valentine's Day. This is Central Time.